We're talking about the disappearance of fertile soil in the Midwest, why wind and water erosion is a threat. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. Scientists from the University of Massachusetts Amherst, they came up with a new estimate recently on how much rich topsoil is gone due to farming. But scientists aren't all on the same page. The USDA's estimates of erosion is much lower. So numbers aside, we look at solutions for helping to rebuild topsoil. Join in on degraded soil. Your questions, 800-642-1234. Jeremy Ziegler is a soil scientist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Natural Resources Conservation Service. Jeremy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning. So the scientists at UMass Amherst, they found that soil is eroding in the Midwest at double the rate of what the USDA says is sustainable. What worries you about their findings?
Well, it's pretty concerning, I think, overall in the U.S., that we are seeing an uptick in soil erosion over the last 10 to 15 years. And we see that based on, you know, higher amounts of rainfall, higher rain events that are causing some of our water erosion. And we also have to take into consideration our wind erosion as well, with some of our stronger storms that we see coming through the area.
So Mother Nature having an impact there on soil erosion, that wearing away of that precious topsoil. And we're going to get to the human effects first, in just a moment. But can you first explain those natural wind and rain events and how that naturally erodes soil?
Right. That's a good question. So with water erosion, that's essentially when our farm fields and agricultural lands are kind of bare, you know, after the harvest in the fall, a lot of our fields are tilled up and kind of left barren for the winter. And that kind of exposes the topsoil to having these water events, rain events come through and essentially wash away our topsoil when we have steeper slopes or when it's unprotected. And then that, you know, topsoil is really prime, rich, fertile ground. And so when the water comes through there, it washes that away and then ends up in our ditches and goes into our lakes and rivers and streams. So protecting our soil is the main thing we want to do. And one of the easiest ways to do that is to have some kind of cover crop or cover over the soil over that time when we're not having crops planted in
mm-hmm.
it.
One of your soil scientist types describes soil as the skin of the earth, and I just found that just so poetic, the layer where rock and life intersect to form the basis of our existence. What is the difference, Jeremy, between healthy soil and seriously degraded soil?
So soil is alive, we say, you know, in the soil business, is soil is living and alive. We have millions and billions of bacteria and microorganisms living in the soil, and they all play a part in that. And so when we see a healthy soil, we have good soil structure that's in the soil that allows that rain to infiltrate through. We have to think of soil as a sponge where we want to soak up that rainwater. And so having good soil structure, good infiltration is key to having a healthy soil in terms of having it available for plants. When we see a degraded soil or a bad soil, if you will, that soil has been generally tilled up and the soil structure is not available. Those pores and void spaces that air use and that the animals need to survive just aren't there. And so, you know, in terms of the bad soil, the infiltration generally is not very good. We have soil crusting on the surface because of that soil structure. And so that's where we start to see the erosion problems, is when the water can't infiltrate through and runs off.
Talking
so
with, oh, sorry.
Tillage and cover, yep, tillage and cover crops are the two main things to help with creating some healthy soils.
I'm going to jump in here and reintroduce you. Jeremy Ziegler, soil scientist with the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service, giving us insight on erosion, soil erosion, and a report that found the Midwest topsoil vastly depleted. You can join in on soil and erosion questions you have, 800-642-1234. Jeremy, you mentioned tillage. We've heard about no-till farming and, what turning up the soil does. What changes can a farmer expect after reducing their tillage?
Well, now if you've been tilling your soil for decades, the first thing you need to know is that it's not going to just change overnight. We know if we can try to minimize the disturbance or the tillage in our soil, that's a great start. But after a couple of years of trying the no-till or reducing your tillage, you're going to start to hopefully see some of that soil structure to get repaired. The aggregates in the soil, the actual soil body, is going to be better for that infiltration of our rainwater, and it's going to, again, act like a sponge. And just reducing your tillage is one step forward, but also, again, cover crops, adding those cover crops to your soil when you're not harvesting and keeping the living roots in the ground as much as possible is really going to help with your just overall soil health in your soil health system.
Sometimes
so you're going to see improved infiltration for sure.
Sometimes when we talk with farmers about their cover crops, it feels like experimentation as you go, if you will, trying different cover crops, seeing what happens, changing things up. Is there not a really good formula for what cover crops to plant where or how to best use cover crops?
And I guess it all kind of depends on the producer's individual goals.
Mm-hmm.
Some cover crops are just solely used for soil cover to keep the soil covered as long as possible. Some cover crops are meant to help build organic matter back into the soil that was lost over, the erosion and years of tillage. So it kind of is individual, but, what I tell producers is if they have a pretty big farming operation is to start small.
Hmm.
Start on a small 20, 40-acre field that they have and to incorporate some cover crops. And there's a variety of different mixes out there and different thought processes on that, and it just all kind of depends on the individual in terms of then how do you deal with those cover crops in spring? Do you spray them off to kill them? Do you plant your crops directly into the cover crops in spring? So, again, it's kind of an individual thing, and everyone's different. And so that's why I think there's a lot of different opinions out there in terms of what's best.
USDA soil scientist Jeremy Ziegler with us, fielding your questions on the loss of fertile topsoil in the Midwest. What changes can be made to farming practices to stop further erosion? Join in on what you see, no-till practices, runoff, plowing, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Jeremy Ziegler here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about erosion that degrades our soil here in the Midwest with an eye on farming practices and what will rebuild soil productivity. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Scientists from University of Massachusetts Amherst, they published this study recently, found the Midwest has lost over 57 trillion metric tons of soil over about 160 years of farming practices. And this is a big problem in the face of climate change. Join in how erosion degrades soil, what the loss of fertile topsoil means for your farm operation, what you see in your community, 800-642-1234. USDA soil scientist Jeremy Ziegler with us here for another 10 or so minutes. Jeremy, we heard from Jeff in Delafield, called, couldn't stay with us, and they asked if the use of corn for fuel has led to an increase in agriculture that ultimately contributes to soil erosion. What do you see there?
That's tough to say. I would say we definitely use corn these days more for our ethanol purposes. But I think we're also a growing world that needs to eat. Mm-hmm. And so having that farmland available for food production is pretty important. But yeah, I think, you know, there probably is more corn being grown in today's age, more, you know, than 30 years ago, based on the ethanol need that we have.
Looking at climate change as well, I can kind of hear this double-edged sword here. You know, soil has a key role in fighting climate change. Massive amount of carbon is stored in soils. But then, as you said there, you have to strike that balance between storing carbon and then also meeting the food needs for growing populations. What do you see there as those two tensions?
Well, you know, I think just generally having soil organic matter in the farm field is very important. It's one of the most important resources we have in our soil. And I think over time, we definitely see less soil organic matter being formed, at least in our traditional farming operations, based on tillage. And so, again, helping with some of these soil health practices of minimizing disturbance and having cover crops and having a living root in the soil as long as possible helps us build that organic matter and helps us have that carbon available for plants and be able to grow, you know, what crops we do grow. We want to be as successful as we can in growing them, and organic matter and carbon definitely play a big role in that.
What about the effects from frequent flooding and wildfire seasons so intense and intense droughts? How is soil erosion affected by climate change?
It's impacted greatly by climate change. I mean, again, just with the larger rainfall amounts that we have, when the soil can't absorb that rainfall with a healthy soil acting like a sponge, we start to see, again, the high quantities of rain come through and erode our topsoil. That is really, that's where the bulk of our soil organic matter is and our soil fertility is. So even adding fertilizers and things to farm fields, you know, we're going to be losing those key soil fertility elements with the erosion. And we know our climate change is ongoing, and with the wind and the rain, those are the main factors. And when we do have wildfires, we are burning off some of that organic matter as well. So it definitely has been increasing over the last decade or so, and it's concerning.
I wonder how you feel about whether soil could be viewed as a renewable resource, because, you know, as we look at no-till and cover crops and all of these ways to regenerate soil, once fertile, rich topsoil is gone, is it gone forever?
Well, I won't say it's gone forever, but just as an example, you know, it takes roughly between 100 and 500 years to form 1 inch of new topsoil naturally. Wow. Without any input. So I definitely, you know, consider soils as not a renewable resource. We definitely have to do our part to help conserve it, and otherwise we're not going to have those fertile grounds in the future generations to help grow crops. So it definitely is going to take humans to help keep soils on the farm field and keep them fertile.
Jeremy Ziegler with us, soil scientist with the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service, as we discuss how to protect healthy topsoil in the Midwest that has been severely depleted by ag production through time. You can join in on soil erosion, what you see, 800-642-1234. Marcus is here from Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus. What's on your mind?
Good morning. So my question is why don't we take and have a paradigm mind shift and go back to what the Native Americans have been doing for hundreds, if not thousands of years, in planting the three sisters, being squash, beans, and corn. The corn acts as a trellis for the beans. The beans puts nitrogen in for the squash, and then the squash acts as a ground cover and also keeps in moisture.
Marcus, thank you for that. Just really describing a cycle of life there, Jeremy.
Yeah, we definitely want to have biodiversity in our crop rotations, for sure. We definitely know that rotating our crops in our field is a good soil health practice. That is maximizing biodiversity is one of our four key health soil health principles that we teach and talk about all the time. And so, yeah, I think definitely having good crop rotation and, you know, instead of using the example of squash, you know, incorporating different cover crops and different biodiversity in that would definitely go a long way. And, you know, we are educating producers every day to try to incorporate the biodiversity into their fields.
Yes,
and
what
most people get that.
What assistance does the state offer farmers and other landowners who are concerned about erosion or who really want to be more active in figuring this out and adapting their land? What programs are out there?
Well, for the USDA NRCS, we offer cost sharing for a lot of different conservation practices. So we help cost share and design grass waterways, for an example. If we do have a steeper field that definitely has a history of gullies and erosion, we can work with those producers to help design and cost share grass waterways. We also have some different EQIP programs for our NRCS programs where we help cost share the cost of cover crops for a, kind of a first-time farmer trying to incorporate cover crops for the first time. So we do have cost sharing, and we always provide technical assistance for any type of soil health management system that a farmer producer is looking to start incorporating. If that's, you know, trying to start to reduce their tillage, trying to have different cover crops associated with their land.
Mm-hmm.
So we're always available for technical advice.
What kind of participation have you seen in these types of programs from farmers over the years? Are they becoming more popular? Are they, you know, staying about the same? What do you see there?
I definitely think that we're seeing more, especially in the last 10 years or so. I know in our agency, in the NRCS, we've really started the soil health journey about, you know, 15 years ago is when we really started to mention these different soil health practices and management systems. But, you know, our agency was created in 1935 based on, we were created just pretty much because of the Dust Bowl and what occurred after that. And so we have been working with farmers since then in terms of putting conservation on the ground with help with soil erosion. But we definitely have seen more activity in the soil health cover crop areas over the last decade.
So as you go through this soil health journey, as you put it, what does the future hold for topsoil in the Midwest? What is that forecast like?
Well, I would like to say it's still in a dire state, I would say. I think we are getting to see more producers are turning to soil health practices and soil health management systems of reducing their tillage and incorporating cover crops. But I think, you know, the majority of our producers are still in the conventional cropping system methods. But, you know, we are seeing more changing. And I think as you go down the future, we're going to, you know, people are going to start to demand more of the products that are being produced to be produced in a sustainable way, incorporating these soil health practices. So, you know, I think the future is looking good, but I think we still have a long way to go.
We only have a minute left or so. Mike from Milwaukee called in and couldn't stick around and wondering how suburban development is impacting soil erosion. What do you see there?
Well, it's definitely, in terms of soil erosion, you know, when we have urban land, we're taking farmland out of production or land out of production, and we're essentially, you know, creating an impermeable surface to that. So by having cement and buildings and things like that. So we definitely would, you know, potentially based on how our drainage systems work, there could be some impact from urban development, but essentially, you know, we're getting more runoff in general in our urban areas that again end up in our lakes, rivers, and streams and carries those different elements with it.
Jeremy, thank you for the update. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. You guys have a great day.
You too. Jeremy Ziegler is a soil scientist with the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. Ahead this hour, Oshkosh needs to fill its vacant municipal jobs, or residents will find their services will suffer. We hear from the city manager about the workforce crunch, how your city is dealing with turnover in the Great Resignation. 800-642-1234 to join in. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We look at the city of Oshkosh's municipal job vacancies as a lens into what your community is doing to keep services intact for residents as job openings soar. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A firefighter opening here, a bus driver position, empty seat there, down an arborist, meaning less ability to deal with the emerald ash borer. Join in on how it feels for you to be short-staffed, how your city is handling the churn, 800-642-1234. Mark Roloff is city manager of Oshkosh, has been talking about this. Mark, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me on, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, lay it out for us. What is your staffing situation in Oshkosh?
We have an over 5% vacancy rate right now. Our human resources department is working overtime, literally and figuratively, to fill a lot of positions. You cited some of them that are that we have actually multiple vacancies, and that's the real challenge when you have multiple vacancies. You've cited a few of them. The other one, I'm glad it's not winter because our equipment operators are probably our biggest vacancy right now. Our equipment operators are the ones who drive our snowplow trucks in the winter. They also fill potholes and do other street maintenance things throughout the summer, and they're also our backup trash collectors. But we are down 7 equipment operators, and that represents about 25% of that entire classification. So that's a significant drop. If it was wintertime, I would be very concerned.
So, you know, as you look across the board here, approximately how, when Oshkosh is full staffed, how many people do you have? And I'm just trying to understanding what over 5% really means.
Yeah, well, I'll do the easy math. We've got about 31 vacancies right now, and our workforce, a full-time workforce, is 550. So doing the math, that's over 5%. And that's significant. I can't remember our vacancy rate being above 3% at any one time. So this is probably double what we've from our worst vacancy I've ever seen in probably my career. And I've been doing this for about 38 years now.
Mm. You laid this out to the Common Council recently last week. What did the Common Council say about these vacancies?
Well, they certainly understand it. And part of my doing it is no different than you or I going into a restaurant. And restaurants are just, you know, been so helpful in just being honest with you about their situation. You know, we're short-staffed. It may be a little longer wait. And that was sort of my way of saying, you know, you're going to have some impacts on services. We try to do our very best all the time. But when you're short-staffed, it doesn't matter. Even your best intentions aren't going to meet everybody's expectations. So you're going to see some slower services. And when a resident has a concern, they're going to call their elected official and let them know. And we wanted the council members to know and do it publicly so everybody's aware that you're going to see an impact on services. And I have people call and submit complaints or something. For the most part, I think people understand it because this is not just a problem with local governments, but people kind of take for granted that, oh, we're always staffed up and we're always ready to go. And generally we are, but this is a unique situation that we're all experiencing.
Mark, I wonder, are the jobs high skill, like you're down engineers, or do you see it more in your part-time seasonal? You know, what is the mix here of your job vacancies?
All of the statistics that I just shared with you, Kate, are all about full-time.
Okay.
But you've added another dimension with part-time. Our summertime help is a real challenge. We've tried to do things to up our wages for the summer help, but I get a sense that we still don't have the full participation of our younger workforce. I think they're not ready to dip their toe in the pool yet. Literally, we have vacancies with our summer pool program. We're probably going to have to limit our hours so that we can be open as much as our staff will allow. And when you have younger people that run the concessions, do the admissions,
and
of course the lifeguards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's a real challenge. Our parks department, we haven't had a single application for summer help. And that's so what we're relying on is our full-time folks, which they're normally doing the mowing because they're in heavy equipment. They're trained to do those things. But we're saying, no, you're going to have to empty garbage cans. You're going to have to do these other rather lesser skilled jobs because we don't have anybody else to do it. And they're going to have to work, more weekends. They're normally 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. But because people use parks and we have to clean restrooms and things like that, we need our higher skill folks to do that, which is unfortunate.
Has your city discussed overtime pay for the people who are carrying out the weight of the workload in these open positions?
Oh, absolutely. But, if you've got a weekend plan with your family, I don't think the family cares that you're getting a little overtime pay to do that. 40 hours, is quite a bit. And summertime is your recreation time. So that's probably been a bigger drag on our folks. Because by law, we're required to give the overtime. That's not the issue. But, if you got a weekend plan with the family and all of a sudden it gets thwarted because your boss says, we need you because we don't have anybody else. I mean, that's just that's a real problem. And I talk about kitchen table conversations with families of our workers. And you go home and you've got to tell your spouse that you're going to be working this weekend and the plans you had with your family to go somewhere are no longer there. You can imagine how that sounds at the kitchen table.
Not going to go over well. Jump in and reintroduce you here, talking with Mark Roloff, who is the Oshkosh city manager, looking at the staffing crunch in Oshkosh, but as a lens through what your community is experiencing well in the municipal workforce. Are there lots of vacancies, or perhaps it's become more stable? What do you see? How are you dealing with the open jobs? 800-642-1234 to join in. Mark, are these wages competitive for the job openings you have?
That is a challenge, and actually we are in the midst of doing a compensation study to take a look at that. We know in a few cases that particularly the jobs that we directly compete with the private sector for, because we have to go through a very open, transparent process, quite honestly, our process is slower. It just is, because we have to go through a lot more procedures to make sure that we're being fair. Meanwhile, for example, the equipment operators, those equipment operators are the same people who help contractors, dump trucks. Think of, construction site, anywhere in the state. Our equipment operators can get offered a higher wage right now. What we try to point out is that when things are a little less busy in the private sector, they may very well get laid off. And we provide more stability because we're always plowing snow in the winter and we're always fixing potholes in the summer. But when they're offering, $5 an hour more, that's up to $10,000 a year before overtime. So it is a challenge. So the positions with competition from the private sector, engineers, accountants, equipment operators, even our arborists, our tree folks, anything that can have a job possibility in the private sector, that's where we've seen the biggest vacancies.
I wonder, when your compensation study is complete, and it says, look, you have to boost wages over X amount of jobs, will your city budget be able to do that? Can you boost wages at a rate that this compensation study recommends?
Well, you're hitting all the right questions there, Kate, because it is a challenge, because we have limitations, levy limits that are in place. And most of these positions I'm talking about are basic general funded services that we provide that are paid with tax dollars. And so that's a huge challenge that we're going to face. Now, the inflation is going to have an even bigger impact, because once the wages, the private sector is going to have to be responsive to inflation as well, and they're going to have to pay their folks more. So, yeah, it will have an impact, because levy limits don't care what the inflation rate is. They talk about new construction. So we're getting really good construction numbers, but it's not the same as what's happening with wages. So, yeah, when we get to that point, that's where we're going to have to make some tough decisions about how we can balance our budget and meet levy limit requirements and yet still pay competitive wages. So
it's a tricky balance.
Yeah, it really is. But it is a dilemma that we're going to have. But we can't ignore what the market says. What we've done with our equipment operators, for example, is we have a range, our pay range. We've been hiring people to the midpoint or even a little higher than the midpoint for starting wages.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we've done it. Normally, we start at the bottom of the scale and they work their way up. Well, we've done that, but that's not sustainable. Mm-hmm. If they're coming in brand new, they need to start at the bottom of the scale, which means...
I'm going to pause right here as we talk with Oshkosh City Manager Mark Roloff with us on the high vacancy rate for municipal jobs, that ripple effect he's been talking about on city services, on the impact of the overall budget. Join in on how your city is addressing so many openings, or maybe that's not the case in your community. You perhaps are staffed up. 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute with Mark Roloff here on the Ideas Network. The city of Oshkosh struggling to fill municipal job openings. We are looking at the implications to city services, comparing what's going on in your community with the worker crunch here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So as governments scramble to fill vacancies, join in on hiring challenges, on low retention, what might reverse the trend in city government openings. 800-642-1234. We have Mark Roloff with us, city manager of Oshkosh, with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Maggie now in Madison. Hi, Maggie. What would you like to bring up?
Hey, I was just curious if there are any efforts or research going into kind of figuring out how to automate some of these positions or things that need to get done as a potential solution.
Automation, Maggie. Thank you. Mark?
That's a great question, Maggie. Thank you. We're always looking for ways that we can improve those processes. In our finance area, we've looked at ways to improve on the number of bill collections. Some people just love to come into City Hall and do visiting and pay their bills face-to-face, but there's certainly better ways to do that. And I think through COVID, we really learned about different ways that we can provide the same service. The customers, our residents, I think got used to that a little better. So in some areas, we've done that. There in our utility operations area, certainly with our treatment plants, automation is a huge part. We always have to have somebody monitoring those things. But, that's one of those areas where we can. When you get to traditional services like cleaning bathrooms and plowing streets, those are things that are services, direct hands-on types of things. Those are a little tougher,
mm-hmm.
So that's a challenge. I can tell you that our information technology or our IT budget has been going up in recent years because we're looking for ways to better automate. So we're always looking for those things. And, you know, that's probably one of the things if I'm, you know, perusing different articles and that, looking for those things and asking our department heads to look for those things. So, yeah, we do it, and we're always looking for better ways. But I think that's something that we do all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly the urgency that Maggie points out is we have to look for ways to do that on a regular basis. So that's a constant that's going on. And I'd say local government, we are always looking for ways to do things better. But the traditional things like snow plowing and whatnot, those are things that we still need the good old human touch.
The good old human touch. Well, I want to bring up your neighbor, Appleton. Rose called in from Appleton, couldn't stay, and they wonder if there are ways to address staffing shortages by bringing in people through work release programs. Have you looked into that?
Well, you know, work release programs are, we still have to have the certain skills. So to the degree that somebody has the capabilities, the training, we can certainly do that. There are certain things, for example, like police, that wouldn't be possible because criminal records. But somebody on work release, if they meet those requirements, we can certainly do that. And I think our Department of Corrections at the state level, I think they try to do training for people in those situations. We could do that for some of our maintenance, but it's getting people to apply. We just are not getting the applications, but that's certainly something that we're open to, and we do consider that.
I would imagine, too, when you have that application in for a job, how quickly can you process them through HR, get them acclimated to the requirements of the specific job? It's not like day one, boom, you still have that lag time to get the worker up to speed.
Yeah, there's always lead time with those things. And just because of the sheer volume these days, we still have to go through our due diligence to make sure that the person's properly trained and they have a work record that will be successful. Because one of the worst things you can do is make a hiring decision that is not good. Then you've wasted that person's time and resources and the city's resources. So we have to make sure that retention is a huge part of our review process, because it's not just hiring somebody, it's hiring and keeping them, so that the investment that we make in an individual is beneficial for that person as well as us.
Let's go to John now in Three Lakes. John, hi, what would you like to bring up?
Hey, I worked for Milwaukee County, and I actually quit because the wages were just so low. I would say I was like a pretty crucial employee. And I know while I was there, they would keep doing these feasibility studies and pay studies, and it would always show that the pay was incredibly low, but they never actually changed the pay. And I just think, you know, us in Wisconsin is an aging state. You know, we're going to need to attract young people or retain young people, and it's obvious that we don't pay enough, so I'm just wondering if we can just cut out some of this unneeded studies and verification and actually just, you know, kind of look at the numbers.
John, thank you. And maybe a little hard to hear, Mark, you know, with all of these feasibility and pay studies, John just didn't see the effects with a boosted wage. And he also said, look, we need that younger generation of workers with our aging demographic.
Yeah, although I heard John loud and clear. I literally heard him loud and clear. But it's kind of the topic we talked about earlier, but with two things. One is when we're in a very transparent type of atmosphere, we have to demonstrate that we have looked at this without showing any favoritism. There's a lot of times in local government that there's concerns that we aren't trying to favor one individual over another. So, and everybody sees what we have, and everybody knows what everybody else makes. And so that slows down the process. And John's right. The process is generally pretty slow. Then there's also the issue that you pointed out, that with our expenditure restraint and levy limits, can we afford to pay that? My philosophy has been we can't afford not to be competitive. So I know there are some communities that do a study and then they don't implement it. That's a huge failure, because you're just you're wasting time, you're wasting money of the study.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, what I've done is give ourselves, 5 to 10 years before we do a salary study. And it's been over 10 years now, and COVID impacted part of that, but we have to get up to market. And if we're not going to be up to market, we're going to have a real challenge. And the situation that John described is going to continue. So most communities will do it, but if they've got budget constraints and expenditure restraints, then if they make the mistake of doing what John said and not implement it the way the market says, you're going to have problems, and you're not fixing them. You're putting them off for a few more years, but then you're really piling on the problem. And that's a huge mistake. And that's probably the situation that John described.
Mark Roloff with us, Oshkosh City Manager, as we look at the municipal workforce, the staffing crunch, how Oshkosh is approaching it. You can join in with what you see in your city government, 800-642-1234. Mark, I would imagine you have the pulse on what's happening in Green Bay, what's happening in Appleton, other neighbors. How is Oshkosh's situation compared to the surrounding area?
Oh, this is very similar across the board. You could have Mayor Gingrich from Green Bay, Mayor Woodford from Appleton, Mayor Rhodes Conway in Madison, any of those folks would tell you pretty much the same thing. And John described it in his question. This problem is existing everywhere because aging workforce, hesitancy to reenter the workforce, our workforce participation rate, both in public and private sector, is low, and we need to bring people back into the workforce and get the proper training done, as the other caller had asked about. Training for people for these jobs is going to be super important. So making opportunities available. We're doing more things with our staff to offer tuition reimbursement to encourage them to seek advanced degrees. We've created a job ladder to show people how they can move up in our organization with proper training, depending on what type of career path you want to follow. So everybody's facing this, and I think we're all discussing these creative ways to keep the talent we have. That is the biggest part. It's keeping the talent you already have. And if you can do that, you're going to be much more competitive.
Mark, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Great questions from your callers and great questions from you. I appreciate getting this word out and getting people to understand our situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark Roloff, City Manager of Oshkosh in the northeastern part of our state. Just ahead, we talk with the author of a new book about DDT, what the struggles over the safety of this chemical can teach us about today's scientific battles. Join in on DDT, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.